Hey, Mark, why don't you tell us about our brand new sponsor?
All right, Jeff. Funky Soul Coffee is a 70s-themed mobile coffee bar in a specially renovated 1975 Airstream trailer. The owners, Michelle and Gavin, have been renovating the Airstream themselves and are planning to launch later this summer. Their dream is to create a unique coffee shop experience that inspires you to reach for your dreams, too.
Welcome to Idaho History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Idaho History. I'm one of your hosts, Jeff Wade, and I'm sitting right across from Mr. Mark Iverson. What's up, Mark?
Oh, you know, Jeff, just ready to get to this one. It's been a long time in the works. Didn't want to be too hasty with it, but we're talking about the Aryan Nations today.
Finally. Yeah, we've been promising it for a while now, right?
Yep. There's been a lot done on the Aryan Nations. Well, at least the Aryan Brotherhood in prison.
Prison gang, yeah.
You know, and Richard Butler, the head of the Aryan Nations, would definitely recruit from prisons. But, you know, they've been talking about in their, you know, crime form as a true crime kind of thing. They've been talking about, I don't know, they haven't been given, I think, a true historical imagining or analysis on a podcast, at least as far as the Aryan Nations ideology is concerned. So,
because there is a crime that was associated with it. Right.
There are quite a few, but yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, most of the podcast stuff that are covered it are more kind of the true crimey, not really well researched type shows, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of mistakes in some of the podcasts that I've listened to about them. The thing is, the Aryan Nations is a huge thing. Like, it's all over the nation. It was kind of the, conceptual kind of, I guess, ideological hub of this was Butler in North Idaho, Hayden Lake. But yeah, they were in Wisconsin, California, you know, Ohio, Washington, Oregon. They were all over. So,
and before we get started, this is quite a hefty script you wrote, all 43 pages of it. So this is gonna
be... but it's in large print.
Oh, okay. Well, so we are getting old.
But
this will be a two-part episode, right?
Yes, for sure.
Okay, so Mark, why don't we get into it?
Okay, Jeff, to the meat of the issue, sir. Yes, so we are talking about the Aryan Nations, but even though I said it's all over the nation, we're going to talk mainly about its kind of conceptual center in North Idaho. But, you know, we're going to focus more on the grassroots movement and how it developed to parallel and fight the Aryan Nations, and the kind-hearted and empathetic leader of, you know, the Kootenai County Task Force, kind of phase two that took on the main brunt of the Aryan Nations onslaught in the 1980s. And his name is Father Bill Wasmith, or just Bill Wasmith as he liked it. And he was from Green Creek, Idaho. But before we get going, I'd like to say, I'm going to read some offensive words tonight, you know, in quotes, and I do this because I think removing the vulgar word from the quote actually diminishes the vulgarity of the perpetrator issuing the hateful words. And so I want our listeners to not, you know, be upset by the words I want them to be upset by the words because they demonstrate the, you know, insidious nature and of these kind of creations that are white supremacists. And I say creations because, you know, white supremacists and then separatists, they are creations, right? You know, nobody's born inherently racist. At least I don't believe they are, but you're definitely taught that. And so I say creations. But anyway, so I'm going to use some terms that will offend people, but only in quotes and only for historical accuracy. So, Jeff, do you have any lighthearted words or, for this lighthearted topic?
Yeah, I really don't have anything much to add. I do like that concept that we're not going to shield how shitty these people were by, you know, pulling back on what they actually said. So I like that.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to just overdo it, you know, but there are a few key concepts that really show their ugliness. And I don't want to not quote what they said accurately. So,
all right. Sounds good.
So at this juncture, Jeff, right before we get going, and especially for this episode, I think it's important to throw out our sources for this one. You know, and they're credible, hefty, good sources. You know, one book I really relied on was Common Courage, Bill Wasmith, Human Rights and Small Town Activism. The other one I read, and it was actually really easy read, was Hate is My Neighbor by Bill Wasmith, with the help of author Tom Alibrandi. Many articles were read from the Human Rights Collection at North Idaho College. I read various articles from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they eventually led the, you know, trial to take down Butler and his Aryan Nations. I read American Hatred, Wild West Myths, Color-Coded Rhetoric, and the Shaping of the Aryan Nations by somebody I know and respect, Alicia Graff. She's a BSU archivist and an all-around cool lady.
Well, hello, Alicia.
Hello, Alicia. And then White Fright, Idaho Grapples with Its Racist Reputation, Choosing Social Justice Over Hate, Two Stories of Community Success in the Pacific Northwest by Tony Stewart and Norm Gissel. They were members of the Kootenai County Task Force. Racial Discrimination in Idaho, Confronting the Myth of the Colorblind State by Professor Jill Gill of BSU. I had the honor of studying under her, and she is a force to be reckoned with and expert in many things. I also read Plain Dixie, Idaho State's Rights Alliance and the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Idaho's Racial Reputation Predates Aryan's Arrival by Professor Gill. And Some Say Potato, Most Say Aryan Nations, Four Decades of Media Coverage of White Supremacists in the Too Great for Hate State by Bill Moreland. And then I read quite a few articles just, you know, from all the different Idaho newspapers.
Yeah. Newspapers.com.
So, yes.
Definitely a robust collection of sources, Mark. Definitely good for this topic. Like we said before, we're trying to get to the meat of this subject and not just a surface level analysis, right?
Nope. We're trying to do something that really hasn't been done. So got to use a lot of great sources.
High five.
High five, Jeffrey. but being aware allows one to confront hate and also helps one not to become a hater themselves. I think white supremacy, hate groups, the Aryan Nations, all of these kind of groups, they all originate within the same place. You know, that xenophobia, zealotry, fanaticism, bigotry, and racism stem from. And that is within the kind of bottomless well of ignorance and desperation. The two go hand in hand, and I think they create hate.
Yeah, like you said before, children aren't born racist. People are not inherently racist. They need to be taught that hate they cling to so fervently later in their lives. You know, I don't know how many photos I've seen of kids in KKK uniforms or holding a Confederate flag, you know, right. That type of stuff. They certainly didn't choose that. To simply call racists stupid and make fun of them, though, is... But to simply call racists stupid and make fun of them, though it is understandable that people do this, is, I know sometimes I do, you know, that just ignores the fact that while deluded, not all of them are stupid. Some are very intelligent and dangerously so.
Yeah. It's a smart practice to understand their beliefs and the individual skills they bring to their hate organization of choice. In short, take your enemies seriously and know them well. However, when I created the Facebook and Instagram post, you know, as a trailer for this episode quite some time ago, some people asked basically, why bring this up again? And one guy was like, come on, you know. Others said it was an embarrassing history and it should be left in the past, you know. And that's what haters want you to do.
But I hate hearing that because it's not in the past. It's bubbled up so right. Bad lately, recently, and it's not going away.
It's not going away. And I guess I understand the, you know, need to put that in the back of one's mind. It's a natural reaction to, you know, save one's own self and sanity. But, you know, they want the masses to become basically complacent and apathetic. The Aryans and their violent, militant, and active offshoots develop in the darkness until they strike clandestinely before retreating again, you know, and then they'll come out vocally at moments. But these are, you know, Jeff and I take them seriously, and we'll discuss them in a serious manner. Not because they deserve our respect for what they believe, of course, but because the serious danger they pose to vulnerable people of different, you know, religions, orientations, skin colors, and, you know, philosophical beliefs, and etc.
So we're going to break the story of the fight against the Aryan nations into some segments. This history, we fervently believe, should not be presented hastily. That's why we're taking our time, and this is going to be a couple long episodes. We will explain the rise of the Aryan nations by dissecting their beliefs as a scientist or doctor might analyze a cancer or, you know, a sickness that they might want to eradicate.
This means we must attempt to grasp the group's twisted version of Christianity, beliefs that make them Christian extremists, really. We will also dissect the movement that led to the downfall of North Idaho's chapter of the Aryan nations, the cure to the cancer of white supremacy, we might say.
So we're going to start off by talking about Father Bill Wasmuth.
Correct, and his origins, yeah.
So most importantly, we are trying to keep this topic in the public's mind to the extent that we can, because they're returning to Idaho and gaining some political backing. As Father Bill Wasmuth knew, good people must stand up to hate wherever, whenever, and however it begins to take root. There's a quote, what is that? The, like, basically evil thrives because a good man does nothing.
Right. Yeah, it's that same idea. Mm-hmm. So, well, let's start by discussing our hero, Bill Wasmuth. I do want to say, however, that many other heroic individuals stood up to the Aryan nations, you know, besides Bill. We will talk about them throughout the show, but Bill was born in a small north central Idaho farming hamlet of Green Creek in 1941. The area had a large Catholic population, and many young men left town in their tweens to go to the seminary school to start the long process of training to become priests.
Wasmuth worked hard for his father, Henry, who, as Bill recalled, possessed a strong moral compass that allowed him to stand up for fairness and justice. Bill remembered an incident in the early 1950s when his father, who ran a small roller rink in town, invited a group of black teenagers working for the Job Corps nearby to skate.
When they eagerly agreed, the white community of Green Creek pressed Henry to ban the kids, but he wouldn't. He said they are children of God like anyone else, and they can skate at my rink. Many whites boycotted his rink, but he would not give in because he said it was wrong. Bill remembered this lesson well.
After working for his father on the farm for his youth, often from dawn to dusk, at the age of 13, almost 14, young Bill decided to become a man of the cloth. His first stop on this journey was to travel to Mount Angel Abbey in 1955. He would be educated by Benedictine monks at the abbey 20 miles south of Portland.
Needless to say, it was strict, tiring, and way old school Catholicism. He learned to pray, then pray some more, and in Latin too. They were busy all day, and for the sake of time, it was not his favorite moment in life, and he missed Green Creek. But he persisted. By 1961, he had been released from the abbey for St. Thomas Seminary above the beautiful waters of Lake Washington, just outside of Seattle. And it's really like 10 minutes away from my childhood home. We'd play there all the time when we were kids. I used to go to Mass there with my friend Chris if I spent the night at his house on a Saturday. But I played Little League baseball, you know, all around at the fields, all around the seminary. It's a nice place and change of pace from Mount Angel Abbey outside of Portland. But that was beautiful, just really harsh.
Sounds very peaceful.
It is.
It was here that the future Father Bill focused more on complex theology and philosophy. Come 1967, he became a priest on May 23rd, 1967, and he would be sent to Twin Falls, Boise, and McCall, Idaho for his first assignments as a parish priest.
It was in the period he spent in Twin Falls that he learned there were real disconnects between the largely Mexican migrant workers and himself. He had been taught to minister to his congregation's spiritual needs, but he also saw that they needed help with advocacy as well, something he knew little about.
While in McCall during the mid-1970s, Wasmuth began enjoying life in the natural wonderland that is Idaho, but his bishop came calling to say he dreamed of a brighter future for Wasmuth, and he wanted him to attend graduate school at the University of Seattle to learn about education. Wasmuth reluctantly agreed.
Once in Seattle, he began to hang out socially with nuns, priests, and laypersons seeking their education. Sounds like a real party, dude. Right? Nuns, none of your business. But he started to really learn the tenets of the Vatican II reforms of the late 1950s and 1960s, instituted by Pope John the 23rd. These reforms led to priests ministering to their communities in common languages like English, German, and Spanish, as well as by them declaring it was the clergy's duty to advocate for the plights of their congregations. Wasmuth's road to the advocate he would become in Kootenai County in North Idaho had been established. And so now we'll move on to Richard Butler.
Yeah, we're going to shift some gears here to talk about really the other end of the spectrum of this story, and to focus on the fouler elements of humanity in the guise of Richard. We might call him Dick Butler. Mark, how does a person become such a hate-filled old man?
Well, Jeff, it seems there are numerous paths to be a racist prick. But Butler became the high priest, or reverend in this case, of an entire movement of hate-filled people known as the Aryan Nations. He was actually the reverend of Jesus Christ Christian Church that he started in Southern California. And we'll talk about that bit later on, but he was also the president of the political wing of the movement, and that was the Aryan Nations. So, as the high leader, you might say, I really see him as the supreme asshole. But ignorance, once again, plays its part.
Butler was born on February 23, 1918, in Bennett, Colorado. However, at some point he moved to Southern California and came of age in East L.A. during the Great Depression around, 1931 time. He went to City College, where he studied aeronautical engineering and science. In a seeming contradiction, Butler joined the Army Air Corps after Pearl Harbor in 1941 and became infatuated with Hitler.
Addie Hitler himself, right?
It's never good when a member of the military becomes infatuated with the leader of the enemy.
Yes, it's a little odd, isn't it? But we're not talking about the good old American, I want to punch Hitler in the nose and nuts kind of fanaticism, send him into the bratwurst grinder kind of infatuation, but more like the I really like what this guy has to say and what he plans to do kind of way. Scheiße.
Yikes.
I'm glad that's your reaction, Jeff. It's a natural.
I could say more, but yes. We'll save it. Okay. Of course, the entire Lebensraum idea of the Nazis, wherein the German army pushed populations out of their home so Germans and other Aryan peoples might live there. Oh, and killed millions of European Jews, Roma, Poles, Russians, disabled, queer, intellectuals, etc., etc. Butler liked that idea a whole lot, so much that he wanted to institute that type of thing in the region of the Pacific Northwest, with the capital of a, quote, white man's land being at Hayden Lake, right off of Rimrock Road.
Prior to his stint in the Air Corps and after his graduation in 1938 as an aeronautical engineer, Butler took a job with the Consolidated Volte Aircraft Company. The company sent him to Bangalore, India, to upgrade airplanes for the Royal Indian Air Force. He was given the rank of captain and was assigned a servant who taught him of the racial caste system and notions of racial purity in India. Butler was enamored with this idea.
He returned to Los Angeles in 1941 and married his fiancée, Miss Betty Litch. And turns out she is a racist as well.
What a match.
Yes. Ooh, love prevails.
Love at first, hateful sight.
Yikes, once more. But anyway, he, like I said, he joined the Army Air Corps and he never left the States. Instead, he taught aircraft hydraulics and aeromechanics.
Two aeromechanics.
What does that mean?
They're aeromechanics, like of planes and stuff.
Oh, okay. So he was teaching them how to fix hydraulics on aircraft.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. But Butler would watch propaganda videos and later stated, quote, "In the newsreels of the day, I was thrilled to see the movies of the marching Germans," he recalled a half century later. "In those days, all we knew was that Hitler hated communists, and so did my folks, as we did as teenagers," end quote. Butler believed a conspiracy led by the, quote, "world Jewry" led to the rise of communism.
Butler had lived in Denver for a time in the 1920s, and he began reading stories from Liberty Magazine, a periodical he would deliver to customers. He read a serialized novel depicting the takeover of the United States by the race-mixing Bolsheviks, a tale that fascinated him. He believed that Hitler was fighting communism and thus Jews. A contradiction developed in which he believed Jewish people both manipulated global economics for personal gain, yet also spread communism around the world, communism being an economic system emphasizing equal assets for all, irregardless of a person's education and skill set. Doesn't sound like a people who want to gobble up all of your profits.
Right.
But I digress.
Yeah, none of this thought process makes sense to me at all.
No.
But after the war, Butler reflected that he had, quote, "fought on the wrong side," even though he didn't fight. During World War II, he started to study the roots of, as he called it, quote, "the Aryan race." He spent a lifetime filling his mind with ignorance and propaganda that created an overwhelming sense of false victimization, which in turn generated a deep hatred for mud people, as he called Black Americans, Hispanics, and Latino Americans, and Asian Americans, you know, among others. Basically anyone that wasn't white, right?
Right.
Of all the people he hated the most, the Jewish people he blamed most of all.
And if you were white and didn't believe in that kind of stuff, you were a race traitor and could be shot.
So, right.
You know, all over the spectrum there. But I'd like to point out how dangerous ignorance and hate can be when just one man is filled to the brim with it. When studying genocide in graduate school and my PhD program, I studied Hitler, Slobodan Milosevic, Pol Pot, etc., all these different dictators. And I can tell you groups might hate, but it takes a certain type of person to galvanize individuals into a hate-based movement. These men always claim they are the chief victims. Most bullies do.
They tend to find convenient scapegoats in the perennial underrepresented and discriminated groups, whether they are Jewish people, Black people, queer individuals, and so on and so forth.
Butler was a different version of the same old shitbag. The crazy thing is, he was doing well for himself, really. In her thesis, historian Alicia Graff points out that he began to raise his family in America, a country doing quite a bit to support its veterans.
Bills like the GI Bill of Rights and Selective Service Readjustment Act, as Graff highlights, aided veterans in paying college tuition, providing job opportunities, and allowing for low interest rates on home loans. He was part of a growing middle class, enjoying the comforts of suburbia, mass consumerism, and an abundance of jobs.
Yeah, what was he so flippin' angry about? It is a fact that veterans of color, especially Black men, were denied the GI Bill's benefits because loan offices, banks, schools, and employers were not obliged to serve these veterans. Graff relied on Thomas J. Sugrue, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North, published in 2008, for that little bit of information right there.
It was the mass fear of communism that really made him such a hater. He started attending meetings for anti-communists, a view the majority of Americans held, without becoming racist domestic terrorists, I'd like to point out. It was very common at the time. This particular group blamed the rise of communism on Jews because, as this group spewed, they controlled world economics, the American government, and the United Nations. They did this to bring about the end of democracy, Butler would trumpet, claiming this would lead to Jews ruling the world and the end of the Aryan race.
As if mass poverty, authoritarianism, and death under the czars of the Russian Empire had nothing to do with it. Unfortunately for the Russians, they simply traded one form of authoritarianism for another.
Through his association with anti-communism groups, Butler was introduced to the Christian Identity Movement and the Anglo-Saxon Christian Congregation Church in Lancaster, California, as well as its pastor, Wesley Swift, in 1961.
Butler felt right at home, as Swift was also anti-Semitic, and tied the Jewish population of the world to the rise of communism and the erosion, quote unquote, of democracy as he saw it. Additionally, as Graf asserts, both men embraced the conspiratorial notion as inspired by Nazi propaganda heard through World War II that America was witnessing a government controlled by the Zionist occupational government, or ZOG as they called it, and the Aryan race's imminent demise.
They believed that by supporting the civil rights movement and feminism, the ZOG government was eroding the fabric of America. The nuclear family, headed by white men, and the economy those men were a part of and maintained. Christian identity, as taught by Wesley Swift and adopted by Butler, claimed that there were two species of humanity, those of Adam and those of Satan, the Adamic being, quote, true men who were the Aryan European descendants of Israel, and then Homo bestialis, the sons of Lucifer, including among others the Jews and Satan's foot soldiers, the Black Africans. Those are the comments of James Aho, Idaho State University sociologist and expert on white supremacists in the United States.
Women gaining an increase in their civil rights and human rights was interpreted as a challenge to the nuclear family, with white men at the head, as they sought work away from home. As minorities achieved rights and an increased presence in white society, white supremacists like Butler believed degradation of the Aryan race, quotes in both cases, by race mixing, quote unquote, would destroy the, quote, white race as whites and minorities interbred.
As historically oppressed groups gained more rights, some of those traditionally in control of society felt as though their power and rights were being taken from them.
A common trope throughout the history of power dynamics, to be sure. However, Butler believed this shit wholeheartedly and thus took to the Christian Identity Church from the outset. As more Black Americans moved to California after World War II, the more Butler became afraid, ignorant, and thus hateful of diversity.
His mind was full of the poisonous rhetoric Hitler and his chief henchmen had spewed around the world in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Like a cancerous tumor, Butler's mind was infected with resentment and spite for the, quote, mud people, as he referred to minorities of colored and Jewish people.
Really, he was a traitor to every ideal members of the military had fought for against the Third Reich and the Empire of Japan. Butler and the Aryan Nations, which would become the political arm of Butler's Jesus Christ Christian Church in Hayden Lake, Idaho, would come to believe that the Third Reich had come closer than any other group in reestablishing the Aryan people. It was all based on a foundation of bullshit, fictional BS poorly dressed to resemble history.
And that's what I think at the root of why this stuff does not make sense to me is they preach Christianity and American values, even though they're the most anti-Christian, anti-American people that I can think of.
I noticed that a lot of their stuff is based on Old Testament,
Mm-hmm.
There's not too much, gospels, there are not too many gospels in there.
Well, if they're the followers of Christ, Christ supposedly fulfilled a lot of the old laws in the Old Testament. So a lot of those don't even apply to Christianity anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, but yeah, they're just picking and choosing things that fit their thought processes, I guess.
For sure. Yeah.
And so Butler and his Aryans sought to reincarnate Hitler's plan for Aryans' racial domination of every other race on Earth, really, but boiled down to the states of the Pacific Northwest. There, Berlin and all this would be Haven Lake, Idaho, where Butler moved in 1973 after Wesley Swift died in 1970.
I feel it's important right now for me to note a difference. White supremacy, and this is something like you would see in the KKK, they would live amongst the peoples that they thought themselves superior to and rule over. That's kind of how they see it. White separatists believe themselves superior and supreme over the mud people, as he called them, and Jews, but they wanted nothing to do with them. They wanted a separate sphere and country, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, in this case, where there were no people of any other color or religion.
It'd be nice if they separated themselves to some island in the Pacific Ocean where we don't have to see them or deal with them.
Oh, they need the beautiful mountains and lakes and all that that the Pacific Northwest offers right there in the corner so they can defend their little patch. Well, too bad it was already taken. But, you know, when Wesley Swift died, Butler was a senior marketing engineer at Lockheed Aircraft in Palmdale, California. So what the fuck was his deal? Seems he had a pretty good, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But guys like Butler, and of course Hitler, they know how to prey upon the misery and ignorance of others, of desperate people. Wherever a white man was out of a job, or wherever affirmative action, at least he believed, earned a black person a job, a white man was a victim. That's how he saw it. Butler sought out the desperate and made them hate those that looked different than they were, and that were vying for some semblance of equality, basically.
So he's taking people that are down on their luck, out of jobs, maybe people that just don't feel like they fit in, and telling them that all their problems are black people.
That's exactly like he. That's why he goes at the prisons. Mm-hmm. That's why he goes to, like, you know, farm workers out of work in that time period, you know, the farm crisis in the 80s, right? And mills and resource-based jobs were closing in North Idaho.
Yeah.
He goes right at those people and says, it's this person and that person.
Again, this is kind of taking a playbook from Hitler, who, you know, rose Germany up out of the Great Depression. But, you know, at the same time, he did that by blaming the Jews for their problems.
Yeah. And see, the thing is that becomes so hard to, like, deal with is that the German people, and the people would probably hate me for this, but there was a grievance. They did have it harsh. There was a lot of shitty situations going on, and they were in a depression, right? Mm-hmm. But
a lot of that was caused by what they did in World War One.
Exactly. So. You know, and yeah, the peace afterwards in the 1930s, some say World War One and World War Two are just the same.
It's a conflict.
Conflict, right?
Well, a lot of people say that the Russian-Ukraine conflict is just the continuance of that.
Right. It just goes dormant for a while. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Hitler knew what buttons to push, but I think he also believed it. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, the Jewish Germans were going through the same thing, and they had fought in the trenches with Hitler. But,
right,
you know, none of these things really make sense all the time.
Exactly. But why did Butler choose North Idaho? Well, he had traveled there with his wife after he retired in 1970. They loved the mountains and the whiteness, not of the snow, but of the people. It was 98% or more white. Therefore, in 1973, he bought a 20-acre plot of land above Haven Lake, just off of Rimrock Road.
Yippee. But why was Idaho so white? What, you know, had made it that way? The more northward one went, the wider it became.
Yeah, these are very good questions and ones that I didn't really understand myself until we dug into this. So thank you for choosing this topic, Mark.
You continue to, like, read it and read it, and, you know, there's always something new to be astonished by.
That's why I love doing this, because I get to learn a lot.
Amen to that, brother.
So we're going to do a brief summary of Idaho's history of being so damn white.
Yeah.
Right.
Why Idaho so white?
You know? But every state in the U.S. has had to deal with racism of its own breed, yet still connected to national trends of racist ideology and beliefs.
Yes, sir. Very true. And Idaho certainly has its own past to reckon with, as does every other state in the Pacific Northwest. You know, we previously, Jeff, talked about Oregon's original constitution. Or, you know, many might not know that Seattle, Washington was heavily segregated, even though it wasn't legal, especially after 1964, but it remained so.
Similar forms of racism and discrimination against the Chinese and Chinese American population crossed state lines in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And of course, the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which I want to do a whole episode on.
Oh, for sure.
That was a national law that re-upped every 10 years. But from the start, as early as 1865, the papers announced with alarm that the Chinese were coming. Campaigns to keep Chinese and black miners from working developed. Their argument was they work for too little and we don't get the jobs.
That's capitalism, you know.
Right, yeah.
But I quote, in 1866, the Idaho territorial legislature levied a tax of $5 per month on all Chinese residents. You know, they couldn't pay this, but and Chinese miners were not allowed to own claims or were forced to pay higher rates for already heavily mined sites.
After the Chinese exclusion in 1882 in Idaho, quote, Edward Stevenson supported the exclusion of the Chinese from the state. And that was a governor, right?
Yes.
Governor Edward Stevenson. Yeah, he supported the exclusion of the Chinese from the state in 1885 and 1888. A combination of this prejudice and a general closing of what was known as the, quote, frontier period led to the return of many Chinese to their homeland and led to others retreating from the mines and into the more established cities. But vigilante groups increased, forcing Chinese workers out of towns. Four Chinese men were lynched in Warren, Idaho. Which is one of the mining towns up in north central Idaho.
Yeah, right. And I don't even recall what they had done or if they had done anything. Do you recall?
I don't. That's a whole story I haven't really looked into that much. But
then I was thinking, you know, there are weird situations where, like, Anthony McBride was hanged for shooting a Chinese man, a pair of Chinese men, right? Or was it
one? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the crowd didn't like it in large part.
He was stopped by the other white men that were around there, and he probably would have shot the other one if they wouldn't have been stopped. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, but by and large, you know, I don't know, like Chinese men experience and women, but Chinese men experienced a lot of prejudice and discrimination.
And so we talked about more of why of some of the stuff back on our Chinese or our Idaho Mythbreakers episode out, we talked about the Chinese tunnel. So if you haven't heard that one, go back, listen to that a little bit. And
we'll be talking about them again. But
definitely.
Chinese communities all over Idaho decreased, and, you know, in Boise, Chinatown died with urban renewal circa 1972. And it wasn't big at that point to, you know, begin with. But, Jeff, isn't there a curse, like, tied to the 1972 taking down of a building that was at the northeast corner of Front and Capitol?
Yeah, so the last resident of – that was Chinatown 2, I believe, right?
Yes, yeah, the first one – Chinese were forced off of Idaho between like 8th and 6th because, well, they said it was a fire hazard, which, to be fair, they could be their establishments because they had to have fires for laundry water to clean the laundry. But other establishments also not owned by Chinese were also fire hazards. It was good commercial front space.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So in 1901, they moved them down to Front Street and forced them out down there and, like, the Grove area.
But, hey, there's a Panda Express there now. So
yeah.
It all worked out, right?
Yeah. I mean, great, you know?
But, yeah, there's supposedly a curse. The last remaining resident of Chinatown 2, a guy named Billy Fong, I believe, he supposedly cursed the area, saying that they're I can't remember the exact words. There's a YouTube video about it, but basically put a curse on that area saying that nothing else would ever develop there. And I mean, it took a while because a lot of that was empty space for a while.
That sculpture fell down that was on the hotel.
Oh, on the Grove, yeah. It's been hit by cars and, yeah.
I don't think that's a curse, though. It's just shitty Idaho drivers.
Yeah, and shitty design.
Yeah, for sure. But the Japanese workers that came to work on the Oregon Short Line in and around 1892, and they came because of the Chinese exclusion law, you know, they came to the U.S. largely to replace these Chinese laborers who left because of racist laws like the Exclusion Act. They faced, the Japanese workers faced similar prejudice as they were blamed for outbreaks of disease in Nampa, a main hub for Japanese laborers, and they were removed to pest houses in the Sage Plains outside of towns like Boise and Nampa. Mountain Home also violently expelled Japanese people as well.
And no, Mark, I'm going to put this in here. The area in Nampa that was Chinatown and where all the both Chinese and Japanese people kind of lived and worked together for a long time, it's called Wall Street, but it's been completely forgotten by our current city government. I was looking at some plans for the area, and they were going to actually redesign that whole area and then use the railroad as kind of the motif for the area. Not a single mention of the Chinese and Japanese residents that were there. So
yeah, you know, down on I'll add this too, down near on the Greenbelt and the Boise River, down in Boise, there's a bridge that was part of it, at least the foundations are still of the original bridge, the Oregon Shortland Bridge that went out to Myrtle and then Front and 10th area where the Oregon Shortline depot was. But a couple of Japanese guys died building that. And on the other side, there is a along the Greenbelt, there is a, you know, history of that area by what's the group that did that? I forget. The Rotary.
Oh, yeah.
They don't mention the Japanese that built the railroad at all.
They have like the signs.
Yeah,
the
interpretive signs about the Oregon Short Line and all this, but they don't mention the Japanese laborers that died building that and maintained the stretch all the way out to Barber and back to Nampa.
If any of our listeners would like to honor those Japanese people, you can do so by taking a trip to Color Lawn Cemetery in Nampa, where most of them were buried, right?
Yeah.
It's very interesting to see their headstones because they're all written in Japanese. So it's pretty cool.
Including the two that died building that bridge across the Boise.
Yeah. So in 1907, the United States government and the Empire of Japan struck the Gentleman's Agreement, as they called it, an understanding wherein Japan. Is that how we're pronounced? No. And this was an understanding wherein Japan would not issue passports to its citizens unless they fit special diplomatic or business criteria. President Theodore Roosevelt agreed to desegregate San Francisco schools for Japanese American students in return.
Of course, Minidoka County is in Idaho, and this is where many West Coast Japanese Americans were forced to live when they were incarcerated at the Minidoka incarceration / concentration camp in 1942 after Order 9066 was instituted that February by FDR signed off on it.
Yeah.
It was these acts and the resultant discriminatory de facto and in de facto policies that led to the drastic reductions in Asian American populations in Idaho.
We're going to be covering Minidoka more probably next month. I've got an interview with an author coming up whose grandparents met and fell in love at the camp. So,
right.
Be doing that, and I'm excited about that. But there were lynchings of Chinese miners and other massacres of large groups of Chinese immigrants on the California Trail and otherwhere too. Also, we shouldn't forget that by 1879, the tribes of Idaho had all been forced onto reservations that gradually became smaller and smaller with land allotments and with that less resources and ways to care for themselves. Right. So you had largely white population centers come by the 1920s.
There were small black communities as well, because just like the white southerners, you know, the newly created Idaho Territory was a good place to get lost and start anew. So black miners faced similar hardships to the Chinese. Railroad jobs proved, employment that black men could get. So you had small black populations developed prior to World War II in railroad towns like Boise and Pocatello, especially. But other jobs were hard to find unless they were service industry types.
Boise and Pocatello were segregated as well. When the black population of these towns were small, you had some individuals live in the predominantly white areas. But as the black population increased, so did discriminatory practices against them, segregation being one of them.
The KKK was active in Idaho after the turn of the century, and they were particularly active in southern Idaho because there was a growing black population, among other groups. But during the 1920s, they were particularly active recruiting throughout the Boise Valley and in Pocatello and eastern Idaho as well.
In September of 1924, there were initiations, parades, and what they call conclaves.
With a K.
With a K, of course, held in Boise and Nampa. The Boise City Band even led a parade on September 6, 1924, and thousands came to watch. And there's that kind of iconic, I don't know if I want to use that word, that photo of the KKK marching right by the Dewey Palace Hotel in
Nampa.
What's
the word when it's not iconic, but it's notorious?
Yeah, notorious. Thank you. That notorious photo of actually, that photo has been banned from local groups.
So, really?
Yes.
From
the Nampa groups, yeah.
Why?
Because it's been shared so much. People don't want to see it. Again, don't want to see this stuff.
Yeah.
Have it in their faces, which they need it.
People love us, then.
Oh, yeah. Well, if they're listening, I hope they do.
Yes.
And we love them, right?
We
love everyone listening. And then in Wilder, Idaho, they held KKK picnics in the park in 1925, and the women of the KKK were active in Boise over the 20s. And Mark, you actually found an application form for that a Boise woman filled out in 1928. They were active, women were, in the KKK, and not just as like auxiliary chapters. They were like, they had their own KKK thing going on.
They had voting rights and could spend money and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And,
very progressive.
Right. In a weird way, the KKK was progressive when it came to women.
Yeah.
Right? I know it's messed up, but.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, so even before World War II, black people were wary of moving to Idaho, but strong communities did develop. But during World War II, as black men worked on bases all across the country, many came to work at Gowan Field, and the River Street neighborhood south of the tracks in Boise grew exponentially. Neighborhood covenants developed, keeping black families from moving to neighborhoods like On the Bench, our friend Angie, right? She looked into that. But one family, the parents of former Senator Sheree Buckner Webb, moved their Sheree and the family to Harrison Boulevard in 1957. And in 1958, they had a cross burned on their front lawn. So
again, we're talking about Boise, Idaho.
Yeah. And that happened, you know, the KKK during their conclaves in 24 had cross burnings out at the fairgrounds. But, you know, this is 1958. Oh, and so the same Sheree, now Senator Webb, right, in 2012 was mailed a harassing letter by the KKK asking her to declare herself basically white and not mixed, as well as stating that she does not date non-white men. I don't know what their idea was, if they're being smartasses or what, but it was insulting to say the least and threatening for sure.
Right. Senator Webb actually was involved with the NAACP at the same time as the subject of one of my blog posts was. If you go to our blog, idahohistory.com, and go to the blog, that post is called Idaho's Black Klansmen, and I'm pretty proud of that one myself.
Actually. Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talk about him. What was his name?
Yeah, so Paul Bellison was a black man from Nampa who briefly joined the KKK, and it was a huge media storm all over the country about it.
Via mail, right?
Yeah, but yeah, he has an interesting story, just not just the KKK part of his life, but his whole life is interesting, so go to our blog and check that out.
Definitely.
Right, so we're going over to Pocatello when the black population... So we're going over to Pocatello. When the black population doubled during World War II, housing was developed for the increase of workers who could not be stuffed into the accepted black neighborhood. I'm guessing that's the terminology that was used. They're stuffing them in. And that caused whites to panic. As Dr. Jill Gill of the BSU History Department illustrates in her article on civil rights in Idaho for the BSU Blue Review, quote, efforts by the Pocatello Housing Authority to turn wartime barracks into homes for black veterans inspired white resistance, for they sat beyond strict segregated boundaries.
In 1950, when the black veteran Willie Evans temporarily moved his family into the barracks, a threatening note reading, "Move out or be moved out on a stretcher," appeared on his punctured tire, according to the Idaho State Journal.
Also, Idaho had a history over the 1920s of forming voting blocks with Southern Dixiecrats. Senator William Borah voted against anti-lynching legislation in the 1920s when the mob violence and lynchings increased exponentially, because he feared federal interference in states' rights issues. These voting blocks continued into the 1940s, 50s, and 60s as national civil rights movements gained ground after black troops returned from World War II, especially against legislation like the National Civil Rights Bill of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Though Idaho had a state civil rights bill in 1961, it was hollowed out by politicians opposed to its particulars. They intentionally made it so the bill could not be enforced, and so segregation at pools, restaurants, stores, and employment in some places continued.
So this was not, if I understand what we're saying here, Mark, this was not segregation that was put into law. It was just that the law did not prevent the segregation from happening.
Right. So, you know, I mean, it was always kind of just, you know, in the North, and not, unlike legal segregation in the South, legal, I quote, right?
Yeah.
Legal, sure. But basically, it was just, you know, practice. So even though laws said you couldn't discriminate or whatever, they just did it anyway. And this was across the North and the West and California and everywhere, you know, by and large.
Yeah. Of course, there's other examples, but these are just some of the reason diversity failed to develop in the Jim State and why Butler chose to move here in the 1970s.
He said it himself. We say that we have the right to maintain our culture and heritage, and the people of Idaho have demonstrated for over 100 years that this is white man's land. Idahoans have white man's culture. They have white man's law. They dress like white men, and they do not need to see this culture destroyed.
What the fuck does that all mean?
I don't know. It's just Idaho, you know, he thought it was the perfect place.
Oh, my God. Okay. He also said, sorry, trying to compose myself when I hear his words. It's hard.
Yes.
He also said, white supremacy presupposes that you want aliens living in the United States that you can act supreme over. We don't want that. Right now, the white race is dispossessed. Right now, there's no place on earth that a white man can say, I'm a citizen of my nation. And of course, we lost the government that was established in Germany for the white race.
Yeah. What the hell is an Aryan anyway? I mean, really? Not what Hitler said or numbnuts Richard Butler, but what have scholars said about Aryanism?
That's a good question.
Aryans were a people who scholars believe first settled in what is now modern-day Iran and parts of northern India. The theory from the Aryan nations themselves is that a light-skinned people called Aryans conquered large swaths of India from the north, and that, and I quote Encyclopedia Britannica, whose literature, religion, and modes of social organization subsequently shaped the course of Indian culture, particularly the Vedic religion that informed and was eventually superseded by Hinduism, end quote.
Okay, so I see the misguided belief of the Aryan nations that they are the descendants of these light-skinned conquerors, but that illogical hypothesis started in the mid-19th century and has, since the middle of the 20th century, been largely discredited by a wide variety of scholars, from historians and anthropologists, archaeologists, entomologists, probably some etymologists.
Oh, yeah. Is that the plant one? Yeah.
Bugs, I think. Yeah, I don't know. Bugs.
Yeah. Yeah, but yep.
Basically, all the experts say it's bullshit.
Yeah, right. I mean, the origins of the term Aryan meaning white and superior comes from a linguist named Arthur de Gobineau of France.
Oh, the French.
Oh, the French. Yes. France, the France of colonialist times, no less. So it served the French well to believe Aryan peoples were superior to the darker skinned people they were controlling and taking over. There were resources to be had in places like Indochina.
Oh, yes. Later in the 19th century, a British and German citizen named Houston Stuart Chamberlain, a disciple of Gobineau, came to define Aryan to mean, quote, white race. Again, he had every incentive to do so, for both of his countries were colonial powers.
Consensus of scholars now believe that the Sanskrit term Arya, meaning noble or distinguished, was a social epithet rather than an ethnic one. So basically, the language of northern immigrants to ancient India had social impacts as immigration occurred, not as conquering people took over territories.
Seen from that light, the label Aryan is totally divergent with the BS spread by the Aryan nations. It basically was the foundation for languages spoken in India and Southeast Asia to form.
This fiction of white superiority was basically invented by members of that so-called race that spoke Indo-European languages and were credited with all the progress that benefited humanity and were purported to be superior to Semites, Yellows, and Blacks, as these diverse populations were called.
Believers in Aryanism, quote, came to regard the Nordic and Germanic peoples as the purest members of the race. This false ideology was grabbed onto by groups like the KKK and the Nazis, blended with historical assertions totally devoid of fact. Hitler and his cronies said it was they who had been victimized by Jews, most of all. So it's so weird because they're taking like these weird interpretations of their mysticism and all that and like creating this weird, like almost science fiction version of history. It's like
it all can't be as accurate sounding as or like realistic sounding as L. Ron Hubbard.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but the idea that we the Aryans are pure and you the inferior races, you know, took what is ours and defiled us, that thinking gave rise to the Holocaust, systematic extermination of 6 million European Jews, hundreds of thousands of disabled people, thousands of gay people, 1 million Roma, perhaps, I'm not quite, but a lot of the Roma, or as they are offensively referred to, gypsies, millions of Poles, millions of communists, as the Nazis defined them, and so forth. Tragic fact is, the Holocaust did not fail. It succeeded in eradicating most of Europe's Jewish population. And though the Jews of the world have endured and succeeded despite their perennial use as a scapegoat for other nations and peoples, crises and tragedies, these are nations Jews themselves, are and were citizens of.
I feel like a lot of Butler's followers probably are Holocaust deniers as well, right?
Yeah, or they say that, you know, in fact, it was the reverse or some sort of bullshit like that.
Or just straight up justified it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to edit one thing. You know, I say, you know, the Holocaust did not fail. It pushed out the Jewish communities in their diversity across the whole spectrum of Europe, you know, from impoverished farmers to wealthy bankers who, again, were placed in that position by necessity, by many of the European nationalities and ethnicities that forced them there, you know. So, and they, a lot of them were very beneficial for the countries that they were a part of. You know, they survive in, you know, definitely in Israel and throughout the world, but Jewish Europe, you know, the Jews of Europe as we knew it prior to World War II definitely ceased to exist as that was. So it could be, you know, the cultural genocide for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, when I went to Poland, you know, Krakow and, you know, Warsaw, I know I didn't go there, but you see what was.
Yeah.
So anyway, these kind of ideas lead to that kind of shit.
Right. And the shit that the Aryan nations promoted was that the Jews are are to blame, and that the Jews are said to control the, quote, mud people, and that's what the Aryans, you know, that's what they were saying. But it was these white Aryans who said they were victims of the Jews, though it was the Nazis whose ideology they claimed to stem from and whose leaders they worshipped. The Jews of the world were reported to control the United States government, the United Nations, and world finances.
Here in America, white supremacists, and not just the Aryans, referred to the conspiratorial apparatus as ZOG, or the Zionist Occupational Government. It was ZOG that was bringing down the white man in America. You know, they mouth farted to the public, I'd like to say. But what is that term, the white supremacists, the alt-right, led by Richard Spencer, shouted in Charlottesville in 2017?
Oh, geez. I think they were saying that the Jews will not replace us. The Jews will not replace us. So basically, you know, the same old shit, different era, you know. There's this whole lineage of the shit.
Yeah, just the shit. That shit. If such hateful rhetoric led to mass murder in the 1940s in Europe and to, you know, the pogroms in Russia and elsewhere before, who can rationally claim that if given the chance, these ignorant and angry white supremacists and separatists would hesitate to do the same thing? Taking it for granted that an extremist group won't gain enough power to kill you is what happened in Germany, you know, and in Bosnia and Rwanda and et cetera.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've gone over a lot, Jeff.
Yeah, we have. So why don't we go and take a pause there, and we will go and cut that as a part one, and we'll talk more about this on our next episode.
It's pretty clear, though, that really – people who are ignorant and full of hate can talk themselves into anything.
That's basically what's going on here, yeah.
And then sell that bill of shitty goods to many, many, you know, scared, disenfranchised, poor, and basically desperate people.
Yep, exactly. Okay, so let's go and stop here. We'll see y'all next time.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.